This is Audible.
Dreamscape presents Maybe in Another Life by Taylor Jenkins Reid, narrated by Julia Whalen. It's a good thing I booked an aisle seat, because I'm the last one on the plane. I knew I'd be late for my flight. I'm late for almost everything. That's why I booked an aisle seat in the first place. I hate making people get up so that I can squeeze by. This is also why I never go to the bathroom during movies, even though I always have to go to the bathroom during movies. I walk down the tight aisle, holding my carry-on close to my body, trying not to bump anyone. I hit a man's elbow and apologize, even though he doesn't seem to notice. When I barely graze a woman's arm, she shoots daggers at me as if I stabbed her. I open my mouth to say I'm sorry, and then think better of it. I spot my seat easily. It's the only open one. The air is stale. The music is Muzak. The conversations around me are punctuated by the clicks of the overhead compartments being slammed shut. I get to my seat and sit down, smiling at the woman next to me. She's older and round, with short salt-and-pepper hair. I shove my bag in front of me and buckle my seatbelt. My tray table's up. My electronics are off. My seat is in the upright position. When you're late a lot, you learn how to make up for lost time. I look out the window. The baggage handlers are bundled up in extra layers and neon jackets. I'm happy to be headed to a warmer climate. I pick up the in-flight magazine. Soon I hear the roar of the engine and feel the wheels beneath us start to roll. The woman next to me grips the armrests as we ascend. She looks petrified. I'm not scared of flying. I'm scared of sharks, hurricanes, and false imprisonment. I'm scared that I will never do anything of value with my life. But I'm not scared of flying. Her knuckles are white with tension. I tuck the magazine back into the pouch. Not much of a flyer? I ask her. When I'm anxious, talking helps. If talking helps her, it's the least I can do. The woman turns and looks at me as we glide into the air. "'Fraid not,' she says, smiling ruefully. "'I don't leave New York very often. This is my first time flying to Los Angeles. Well, if it makes you feel any better, I fly a fair amount, and I can tell you, with any flight, it's really only takeoff and landing that are hard. We've got about 3 more minutes of this part, and then about 5 minutes at the end that can be tough. The rest of it? You might as well be on a bus. So just 8 bad minutes total, and then you're in California. We're at an incline. It's steep enough that an errant bottle of water rolls down the aisle. 8 minutes is all? She asks. I nod. That's it, I tell her. You're from New York? She nods. How about you? I shrug. I was living in New York. Now I'm moving back to L.A. The plane drops abruptly and then rights itself as we make our way past the clouds. She breathes in deeply. I have to admit, even I feel a little queasy. But I was only in New York for about 9 months, I say. The longer I talk, the less attention she has to focus on the turbulence. I've been moving around a bit lately. I went to school in Boston, then I moved to D.C., then Portland, Oregon, then Seattle, then Austin, Texas, then New York. The city where dreams come true. Although, you know, not for me. But I did grow up in Los Angeles, so you could say I'm going back to where I came from, but I don't know that I'd call it home. Where's your family? She asks. Her voice is tight. She's looking forward. My family moved to London when I was 16. My younger sister, Sarah, got accepted to the Royal Ballet School, and they couldn't pass that up. I stayed and finished school in L.A. You lived on your own? It's working. The distraction. I lived with my best friend's family until I finished high school, and then I left for college. The plane levels out. The captain tells us our altitude. She takes her hands off the armrest and breathes. See? I say to her. Just like a bus. Thank you, she says. Anytime. She looks out the window. I pick up the magazine again. She turns back to me. Why do you move around so much? She says. Isn't that difficult? She immediately corrects herself. Listen to me. The minute I stop hyperventilating, I'm acting like your mother. I laugh with her. No, no, it's fine, I say. I don't move from place to place on purpose. It's not a conscious choice to be a nomad, although I can see that each move is my own decision, predicated on nothing but my ever-growing sense that I don't belong where I am, fueled by the hope that maybe there is, in fact, a place I do belong, a place just off in the future. I guess, I don't know, I say. It's hard to put into words, especially to someone I barely know. But then I open my mouth, and out it comes. No place has felt like home. She looks at me and smiles. I'm sorry, she says. That has to be hard. I shrug, because it's an impulse. It's always my impulse to ignore the bad, to run toward the good. But I'm also not feeling great about my own impulses at the moment. I'm not sure they are getting me where I want to go. I stop shrugging. And then, because I won't see her again after this flight, I take it one step further. I tell her something I've only recently told myself. Sometimes I worry I'll never find a place to call home. She puts her hand on mine, ever so briefly. You will, she says. You're young still. You have plenty of time. I wonder if she can tell that I'm 29 and considers that young, or if she thinks I'm younger than I am. Thanks, I say. I take my headphones out of my bag and put them on. At the end of the flight, during the 5 tricky minutes when we land, maybe we can talk about my lack of career choices, I say, laughing. That will definitely distract you. She smiles broadly and lets out a laugh. I'd consider it a personal favor. When I come out of the gate, Gabby is holding up a sign that says, Hannah Marie Martin, as if I wouldn't recognize her, as if I wouldn't know she was my ride. I run toward her, and as I get closer, I can see that she has drawn a picture of me next to my name. It is a crude sketch, but not altogether terrible. The Hannah of her drawing has big eyes and long lashes, a tiny nose, and a line for a mouth. On the top of my head is hair drawn dramatically in a high bun. The only thing of note drawn on my stick figure body is an oversized pair of boobs. It's not necessarily how I see myself, but I admit, if you reduced me to a caricature, I'd be big boobs and a high bun. Sort of like how Mickey Mouse is round ears and gloved hands, or how Michael Jackson is white socks and black loafers. I'd much rather be depicted with my dark brown hair and my light green eyes, but I understand that you can't really do much with color when you're drawing with a Bic pen. Even though I haven't visited Gabby in person since her wedding day 2 years ago, I have seen her every Sunday morning of the recent past. We video chat no matter what we have to do that day, or how hungover one of us is feeling. It is, in some ways, the most reliable thing in my life. Gabby is tiny and twig-like. Her hair is kept cropped close in a bob, and there's no extra fat on her, not an inch to spare. When I hug her, I remember how odd it is to hug someone so much smaller than I am, how different the two of us seem at first glance. I'm tall, curvy, and white. She is short, thin, and black. She doesn't have any makeup on, and yet she is one of the prettiest women here. I don't tell her that, because I know what she'd say. She'd say that's irrelevant. She'd say we shouldn't be complimenting each other on our looks or competing with each other over who is prettier. She's got a point, so I keep it to myself. I have known Gabby since we were both 14 years old. We sat next to each other in earth science class the first day of high school. The friendship was fast and everlasting. We were Gabby and Hannah, Hannah and Gabby, one name rarely mentioned without the other in tow. I moved in with her and her parents, Carl and Tina, when my family left for London. Carl and Tina treated me as if I were their own. They coached me through applying for schools, made sure I did my homework, and kept me on a curfew. Carl routinely tried to persuade me to become a doctor, like him and his father. By then, he knew that Gabby wouldn't follow on his path. She already knew she wanted to work in public service. I think Carl figured I was his last shot. But Tina instead encouraged me to find my own way. Unfortunately, I'm still not sure what that way is. But back then, I just assumed it would all fall into place, that the big things in life would take care of themselves. After we went off to college, Gabby in Chicago, myself in Boston, we still talked all the time, but started to find new lives for ourselves. Freshman year, she became friends with another black student at her school named Vanessa. Gabby would tell me about their trips to the nearby mall and the parties they went to. I'd have been lying if I said I wasn't nervous back then, in some small way, that Vanessa would become closer to Gabby than I ever could, that Vanessa could share something with Gabby that I was not a part of. I asked Gabby about it over the phone once. I was lying in my dorm room on my twin XL bed, the phone sweaty and hot on my ear from our already hours-long conversation. "Do you feel like Vanessa understands you better than I do?" I asked her. "Because you're both black?" The minute the question came out of my mouth, I was embarrassed. It had seemed reasonable in my head, but sounded irrational coming out of my mouth. If words were things, I would have rushed to pluck them out of the air and put them back in my mouth. Gabby laughed at me.
"Do you think white people understand you more than I do just because they're white?"
"No," I said. "Of course not."
"So be quiet," Gabby said.
And I did. If there is one thing I love about Gabby, it is that she has always known when I should be quiet. She is, in fact, the only person who often proves to know me better than I know myself.
"Let me guess," she says now, as she takes my carry-on bag out of my hand, a gentlemanly gesture. "We're going to need to rent one of those baggage carts to get all of your stuff."
I laugh. "In my defense, I am moving across the country," I say. I long ago stopped buying furniture or large items. I tend to sublet furnished apartments. You learn after one or two moves that buying an IKEA bed, putting it together, and then breaking it down and selling it for $50 6 months later is a waste of time and money. But I do still have things, some of which have survived multiple cross-country trips. It would feel callous to let go of them now.
"I'm going to guess there's at least 4 bottles of orange ginger body lotion in here," Gabby says as she grabs one of my bags off the carousel.
I shake my head. "Only the one. I'm running low." I started using body lotion somewhere around the time she and I met. We would go to the mall together and smell all the lotions in all the different stores. But every time I kept buying the same one, orange ginger. At one point, I had 7 bottles of the stuff stocked up. We grab the rest of my bags from the carousel and pack them one after another onto the cart, the two of us pushing with all our might across the lanes of airport traffic and into the parking structure. We load them into her tiny car and then settle into our seats. We make small talk as she makes her way out of the garage and navigates the streets leading us to the freeway. She asks about my flight and how it felt to leave New York. She apologizes that her guest room is small. I tell her not to be ridiculous, and I thank her again for letting me stay. The repetition of history is not lost on me. It's more than a decade later, and I am once again staying in Gabby's guest room. It's been more than 10 years, and yet I am still floating from place to place, relying on the kindness of Gabby and her family. This time, it's Gabby and her husband Mark, instead of Gabby and her parents. But if anything, that just highlights the difference between the two of us, how much Gabby has changed since then, and how much I have not. Gabby's the VP of development at a nonprofit that works with at-risk teenagers. I'm a waitress, and not a particularly good one. Once Gabby is flying down the freeway, once driving no longer takes her attention, or maybe once she is going so fast she knows I can't jump out of the car, she asks what she has been dying to ask since I hugged her hello.
"So what happened? Did you tell him you were leaving?"
I sigh loudly and look out the window. "He knows not to contact me," I say. "He knows I don't want to see him ever again, so I suppose it doesn't really matter where he thinks I am." Gabby looks straight ahead at the road, but I see her nod, pleased with me. I need her approval right now. Her opinion of me is currently a better litmus test than my own. It's been a little rough going lately. And while I know Gabby will always love me, I also know that as of late, I have tested her unconditional support. Mostly because I started sleeping with a married man. I didn't know he was married at first, and for some reason, I thought that meant it was okay. He never admitted he was married. He never wore a wedding ring. He didn't even have a paler shade of skin around his ring finger, the way magazines tell you married men will. He was a liar. A good one at that. And even though I suspected the truth, I thought that if he never said it, if he never admitted it to my face, then I wasn't accountable for the fact that it was true. I suspected something was up when he once didn't answer my calls for 6 days, and then finally called me back acting as if nothing was out of the ordinary. I suspected there was another woman when he refused to let me use his phone. I suspected that I was, in fact, the other woman when we ran into a co-worker of his at a restaurant in Soho, and rather than introduce me to the man, Michael told me I had something in my teeth and that I should go to the bathroom to get it out. I did go to the bathroom, and I found nothing there. But if I'm being honest, I also found it hard to look at myself in the mirror for more than a few seconds before going back out there and pretending I didn't know what he was trying to do. And Gabby, of course, knew all of this. I was admitting it to her at the same rate I was admitting it to myself. "I think he's married," I finally said to her a month or so ago. I was sitting in bed, still in my pajamas, talking to her on my laptop and fixing my bun. I watched as Gabby's pixelated face frowned.
"I told you he was married," she said, her patience wearing thin. "I told you this 3 weeks ago. I told you that you need to stop this, because it's wrong, and because that is some woman's husband, and because you shouldn't allow a man to treat you like a mistress. I told you all of this." "I know, but I really didn't think he was married. He would have told me if he was, you know? So I didn't think he was. And I'm not going to ask him, because that's so insulting, isn't it?"
That was my rationale. I didn't want to insult him.
"You need to cut this crap out, Hannah. I'm serious. You are a wonderful person who has a lot to offer the world. But this is wrong, and you know it."
I listened to her. And then I let all of her advice fly right through my head and out into the wind, as if it was meant for someone else and wasn't mine to hold on to. "No," I said, shaking my head. "I don't think you're right about this. Michael and I met at a bar in Bushwick on a Wednesday night. I never go to Bushwick, and I rarely go out on a Wednesday night, and neither does he. What are the odds of that, that two people would come together like that?"
"You're joking, right?"
"Why would I be joking? I'm talking about fate here. Honestly. Let's say he is married."
"He is."
"We don't know that, but let's say he is."
"He is."
"Let's say that he is. That doesn't mean that we weren't fated to meet. For all we know, I'm just playing out the natural course of destiny here. Maybe he's married, and that's okay, because it's how things were meant to be." I could tell Gabby was disappointed in me. I could see it in her eyebrows and the turn of her lips.
"Look, I don't even know that he's married," I said.
But I did. I did know it. And because I knew it, I had to run as far away from it as I could. So I said,
"You know, Gabby, even if he is married, that doesn't mean I'm not better for him than this other person. All's fair in love and war."
2 weeks later, his wife found out about me and called me screaming. He'd done this before. She'd found two others. And did I know they had two children? I did not know that. It's very easy to rationalize what you're doing when you don't know the faces and the names of the people you might hurt. It's very easy to choose yourself over someone else when it's an abstract. And I think that's why I kept everything abstract. I had been playing the "well, but" game. The "we don't know that for sure" game. The "even so" game. I had been viewing the truth through my own little lens, one that was narrow and rose-colored. And then suddenly, it was as if the lens fell from my face, and I could suddenly see, in staggering black and white, what I had been doing. Does it matter that once I faced the truth, I behaved honorably? Does it matter that once I heard his wife's voice, once I knew the names of his children, I never spoke to him again? Does it matter that I can see, clear as day, my own culpability and that I feel deep remorse, that a small part of me hates myself for relying on willful ignorance to justify what I suspected was wrong? Gabby thinks it does. She thinks it redeems me. I'm not so sure. Once Michael was out of my life, I realized I didn't have much else going for me in New York. The winter was harsh and cold, and only seemed to emphasize further how alone I was in a city of millions. I called my parents and my sister Sarah a lot that first week after breaking up with Michael, not to talk about my problems, but to hear friendly voices. I often got their voicemails. They always called me back. They always do. But I could never seem to accurately guess when they might be available. And very often, with the time difference, we had only a small sliver of time to catch one another. Last week, everything just started to pile up. The girl whose apartment I was subletting gave me 2 weeks' notice that she needed the apartment back. My boss at work hit on me and implied that better shifts went to women who showed cleavage. I got stuck on the G train for an hour and 45 minutes when a train broke down at Greenpoint Avenue. Michael kept calling me and leaving voicemails, asking to explain himself, telling me that he wanted to leave his wife for me, and I was embarrassed to admit that it made me feel better, even as it made me feel absolutely terrible. So I called Gabby, and I cried. I admitted that things were harder in New York than I had ever let on. I admitted that this wasn't working, that my life was not shaping up the way I'd wanted it to. I told her I needed to change. And she said, "Come home." It took me a minute before I realized she meant that I should move back to Los Angeles. That's how long it's been since I thought of my hometown as home. "To L.A.?" I asked. "Yeah," she said. "Come home." "You know Ethan is there," I said. "He moved back a few years ago, I think."
"So you'll see him," Gabby said. "It wouldn't be the worst thing that happened to you, getting back together with a good guy."
"It is warmer there," I said, looking out my tiny window at the dirty snow on the street below me.
"It was 72 the other day," she said.
"But changing cities doesn't solve the larger problem," I said, for maybe the first time in my life.
"I mean, I need to change." "I know," she said. "Come home. Change here."
It was the first time in a long time that something made sense. Now Gabby grabs my hand for a moment and squeezes it, keeping her eye on the road.
"I'm proud of you that you're taking control of your life," she says. "Just by getting on the plane this morning, you're getting your life together."
"You think so?" I ask. She nods.
"I think Los Angeles will be good for you. Don't you? Returning to your roots? It's a crime we've lived so far apart for so many years. You're correcting an injustice."
I laugh. I'm trying to see this move as a victory instead of a defeat. Finally, we pull onto Gabby Street, and she parks her car at the curb. We are in front of a complex on a steep, hilly street. Gabby and Mark bought a townhouse last year. I look at the addresses on the row of houses and search for the number 4 to see which one is theirs. I may not have been here before, but I've been sending cards, baked goods, and various gifts to Gabby for months. I know her address by heart. Just as I catch the number on the door in the glow of the streetlight, I see Mark come out and walk toward us. Mark is a tall, conventionally handsome man, very physically strong, very traditionally male. I've always had a penchant for guys with pretty eyes and 5 o'clock shadows, and I thought Gabby did too. But she ended up with Mark, the poster boy for clean cut and stable. He's the kind of guy who goes to the gym for health reasons. I have never done that. I open my car door and grab one of my bags. Gabby grabs another. Mark meets us at the car.
"Hannah," he says as he gives me a big hug. "It is so nice to see you."
He takes the rest of the bags out of the car, and we head into the house. I look around their living room. It's a lot of neutrals and wood finishes. Safe, but gorgeous.
Your room is upstairs, she says, and the three of us walk up the tight staircase to the second floor. There is a master bedroom and a bedroom across the hall. Gabby and Mark lead me into the guest room, and we put all the bags down. It's a small room, but big enough for just me. There's a double bed with a billowy white comforter, a desk, and a dresser. It's late, and I am sure both Gabby and Mark are tired, so I do my best to be quick. You guys go ahead to bed. I can get myself settled, I say. You sure? Gabby asks. I insist. Mark gives me a hug and heads to their bedroom. Gabby tells him she'll be there in a moment. I'm really happy you're here, she says to me. In all of your city hopping, I always hoped you'd come back. At least for a little while. I like having you close by. Well, you got me, I tell her, smiling. Perhaps even closer than you were thinking. Don't be silly, she says. Live in my guest room until we're both 90 years old as far as I'm concerned. She gives me a hug and heads to her room. If you wake up before we do, feel free to start the coffee. After I hear the bedroom door shut, I grab my toiletry bag and head into the bathroom. The light in here is bright and unforgiving. Some might even go so far as to describe it as harsh. There's a magnifying mirror by the sink. I grab it and pull it toward my face. I can tell I need to get my eyebrows waxed, but overall there isn't too much to complain about. As I start to push the mirror back into place, the view grazes the outside of my left eye. I pull on my skin, somewhat in denial of what I'm seeing. I let it bounce back into shape. I stare and inspect. I have the beginnings of crow feet. I have no apartment and no job. I have no steady relationship or even a city to call home. I have no idea what I want to be doing with my life, no idea what my purpose is, and no real sign of a life goal. And yet, time has found me. The years I've spent dilly-dallying around at different jobs in different cities show on my face. I have wrinkles. I let go of the mirror. I brush my teeth, I wash my face, I resolve to buy night cream and start wearing sunscreen, and then I turn down the covers and get into bed. My life may be a little bit of a disaster. I may not make the best decisions sometimes, but I am not going to lie here and stare at the ceiling, worrying the night away. Instead, I go to sleep soundly, believing I will do better tomorrow. Things will be better tomorrow. I'll figure this all out tomorrow. Tomorrow is, for me, a brand new day. I wake up to a bright, sunny room and a ringing phone.
Ethan,
I whisper into the phone.
It's 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning.
Yeah, he says, his gritty voice made grittier by the phone. But you're still on East Coast time. It's noon for you. You should be up.
I continue to whisper.
Okay, but Gabby and Mark are still sleeping.
When do I get to see you?
He says. I met Ethan in my sophomore year of high school at homecoming. I was still living at home with my parents. Gabby was offered a babysitting job that night and decided to take it instead of going to the dance. I ended up going by myself. Not because I wanted to go, but because my dad teased me that I never went anywhere without her. I went to prove him wrong. I stood at the wall for most of the night, killing time until I could leave. I was so bored that I thought about calling Gabby and persuading her to join me once her babysitting gig was over. But Jesse Flint was slow dancing with Jessica Campos all night in the middle of the dance floor. And Gabby loved Jesse Flint, had been pining away for him since high school began. I couldn't do that to her. As the night wore on and couples started making out in the dimly lit gym, I looked over at the only other person standing against the wall. He was tall and thin, with rumpled hair and a wrinkled shirt. His tie was loose. He looked right back at me, and then he walked over to where I was standing and introduced himself.
Ethan Hanover, he said, putting out his hand.
Hannah Martin, I said, putting out my own to grab his. He was a junior at another school.
He told me he was just there as a favor to his neighbor, Katie Franklin, who didn't have a date. I knew Katie fairly well. I knew she was a lesbian who wasn't ready to tell her parents. The whole school knew that she and Teresa Hawkins were more than just friends. So I figured I wasn't hurting anyone by flirting with the boy she brought for cover. But pretty soon, I found myself forgetting anyone else was even at the dance in the first place. When Katie did finally come get him and suggest it was time to go, I felt as if something was being taken from me. I was tempted to reach out and grab him, to claim him for myself. Ethan had a party at his parents' house the next weekend and invited me. Gabby and I didn't normally go to big parties, but I made her come. He perked up the minute I walked in the door. He grabbed my hand and introduced me to his friends. I lost track of Gabby somewhere by the Tostitos. Soon, Ethan and I had ventured upstairs. We were sitting on the top step of the staircase, hip to hip, talking about our favorite bands. He kissed me there, in the dark, the wild party happening just underneath our feet.
"I only threw a party so I could call and invite you," he said to me. "Is that stupid?"
I shook my head and kissed him again. When Gabby came and found me an hour or so later, my lips felt swollen, and I knew I had a hickey. We lost our virginity to each other a year and a half later. We were in his bedroom when his parents were out of town. He told me he loved me as I lay underneath him, and he kept asking if it was okay. Some people talk about their first time as a hilarious or pathetic experience. I can't relate. Mine was with someone I loved, someone who also had no idea what we were doing. The first time I had sex, I made love. I've always had a soft spot in my heart for Ethan for that very reason. And then everything fell apart. He got into UC Berkeley, Sarah got into the Royal Ballet School, and my parents packed up and moved to London. I moved in with the Hudsons. And then, one balmy August morning, a week before the beginning of my senior year of high school, Ethan got into his parents' car and left for Northern California. We made it until the end of October before we broke up. At the time, we assured each other that it was just because the timing was wrong and the distance was hard. We told each other we'd get back together that summer. We told each other it didn't change anything. We were still soulmates. But it was no different from the same old song and dance at every college every fall. I started considering schools in Boston and New York, since living on the East Coast would make it easier to get to London. When Ethan came home for Christmas, I was dating a guy named Chris Rodriguez. When Ethan came home for the summer, he was dating a girl named Alicia Foster. When I got into Boston University, that was the final nail. Soon, there was more than 3,000 miles between us and no plan to shorten the distance. Ethan and I have occasionally kept in touch, a phone call here or there, a dance or two at mutual friends' weddings. But there has always been an unspoken tension. There is always this sense that we haven't followed through on our plan. He still, all these years later, shines brighter to me than other people. Even after I got over him, I was never able to extinguish the fire completely, as if it's a pilot light that will remain small and controlled, but very much alive.
"You've been in this city for 12 hours, according to my calculations," Ethan says, "and I'll be damned if I'm going to let you be here for 12 more without seeing me."
I laugh. "Well, we'll be cutting it close, I think," I say to him. "Gabby says there is some bar in Hollywood that we should go to tonight. She invited a whole bunch of friends from high school, so I can see everybody again. She's calling it a housewarming, which makes no sense. I don't know." Ethan laughs.
"Text me the time and place, and I will be there."
"Awesome. Sounds great." I start to say goodbye, but his voice chimes in again.
"Hey, Hannah," he says.
"Yeah?"
"I'm glad you decided to come home."
I laugh. "Well, I was running out of cities."
"I don't know," he says. "I like to think you've just come to your senses."
I am pulling things out of my suitcase and flinging them around the guest room. "I swear I will clean this up," I say to Gabby and Mark. They are dressed and standing by the door. They have been ready to go for at least 10 minutes.
It's not a fashion show, Gabby says. It's my first night back in Los Angeles, I remind her. I want to look good.
I had on a black shirt and black jeans with long earrings and, of course, a high bun. But then I thought, you know, this isn't New York anymore. This is L.A. It was 60 degrees out this afternoon.
I just want to find a tank top, I say.
I start filtering through the clothes I have already thrown across the room. I find a teal shell tank and throw it on. I slip on my black heels. I look in the mirror and fix my bun.
I promise I will clean this all up when we get back.
I can see Mark laughing at me. He knows I sometimes don't do exactly what I say I'll do. No doubt, when Gabby asked him if I could stay here, she prepared him by saying she will probably throw her stuff all over the place. Also, I have no doubt he said that was okay, so I don't feel too bad. But I don't think that is why Mark is laughing, actually. He says,
"For someone so disorganized, you look very pulled together."
Gabby smiles at him, and then at me.
"You do. You look, like, glowy."
She grabs the doorknob and then says,
"But looks aren't the measure of a woman."
She can't stop herself. This political correctness is just a part of who she is. I love her for that.
"Thank you both," I say, as I follow them to their car.
When we get to the bar, it's fairly quiet. Gabby and Mark sit down, and I go up to get our drinks. I order beers for Mark and me, and a glass of Chardonnay for Gabby. The bill comes to $24, and I hand over my credit card. I don't know how much money I have in my account, because I'm afraid to look. But I know I have enough to live for a few weeks and get an apartment. I don't want to be a person who nickels and dimes, especially when Mark and Gabby have been sweet enough to give me a place to stay, so I just put it out of my head. I bring the two beers to the table and turn back to get Gabby's wine. By the time I sit down, another woman has joined us. I remember meeting her at Gabby and Mark's wedding a couple of years ago. Her name is Catherine, I believe. She ran the New York City Marathon a few years ago. I remember faces and names really well. It's easy for me to remember details about people I have only met once. But I learned a long time ago not to reveal this. It freaks people out. Catherine extends her hand.
"Catherine," she says.
I shake her hand and say my name.
"Nice to meet you," she says. "Welcome back to Los Angeles."
"Thanks," I say.
"Actually, I think we've met before."
"We have?"
"Yeah, at Gabby and Mark's wedding."
Yeah, I say, as if it's coming back to me.
"You were telling me about how you ran a marathon somewhere, right? Boston or New York?"
She smiles.
"New York? Yes, great memory."
And now Catherine likes me. If I'd come right out with it, if I'd said, "Oh, we've met before. You were wearing a yellow dress at their wedding, and you said that running the New York Marathon was the hardest but most rewarding thing you've ever done," Catherine would think I was creepy. I have learned this the hard way. Soon, some of my old friends from high school start trickling in, the girls Gabby and I hung out with. Bryn, Caitlin, Erica. I scream and shout at the top of my lungs when I see each of them. It is so nice to see familiar faces, to be somewhere and know that the people who knew you at 15 still like you. Bryn looks older, Caitlin looks thinner, Erica looks just the same. Some of Mark's friends from work show up with their spouses, and soon we are crowding around a table too small for us. People start buying other people drinks. Rounds are on this person or that person. I nurse my beer and a few Diet Cokes. I drank a lot in New York. I drank a lot with Michael. Change starts now. I'm up at the bar again when I see Ethan walk in the door. He's even taller than I remember, wearing an untucked blue cotton button-down and dark jeans. His hair is short and tousled, his stubble a few days old. He was cute in high school. He's handsome now. He will only get more handsome as he ages, I suspect. I wonder if he has crow's feet like I do. I watch as he scouts around, searching for me in the crowd. I pay for the drinks in my hand and walk toward him. Just when I worry he'll never see me, I finally catch his eye. He lights up and smiles wide. He moves toward me quickly, the gap between us almost instantly reduced to zero. He throws his arms around me and squeezes me tight. I briefly put the drinks down on the edge of the bar so I don't spill them.
"Hi," he says.
"You're here," I say.
"You're here," he says.
I hug him again.
"It's really great to see you,"
he tells me.
"Beautiful as ever."
"Thank you kindly," I say. Gabby makes her way toward us.
"Gabby Hudson," he says, leaning in to give her a hug.
"Ethan," she says, "good to see you."
"I'm going to grab a drink, and I'll meet you in a minute,"
he says to us. I nod at him, and Gabby and I turn back toward our table. She raises her eyebrows at me. I roll my eyes at her. An entire conversation without a word spoken. Soon the music is so loud and the bar is so crowded that conversation becomes difficult. I'm trying to hear what Caitlin is saying when Ethan gets to the table. He stands next to me, resting with his arm up against mine without a hint of self-consciousness. He sips his beer and turns to Catherine, the two of them trying to hear each other over the music. I glance over for a moment to find him looking intently at her, gesturing as if he's making a joke. I watch as she throws her head back and laughs. She's prettier than I realized. She seemed plain before, but I can see now that she's quite striking. Her long blonde hair is blown out straight. Her sapphire blue dress flatters her, hanging off her body effortlessly. It doesn't even look as if she needs to wear a bra. I can't go anywhere without a bra. Gabby pulls at my hand and drags me onto the dance floor. Caitlin joins us, and then Erica and Bryn do too. We dance to a few songs before I see Ethan and Catherine come over to join us. Mark hangs back with the others, nursing his beer. "He doesn't dance?" I ask Gabby. Gabby rolls her eyes. I laugh as Catherine, twirling, catches my eye. Ethan is spinning her. I wonder if he'll take her home. I am surprised at how much this idea bothers me, just how unsubtle my feelings are. He laughs as the song ends. They break apart, and he high-fives her. It seems like a friendly gesture, as opposed to a romantic one. Looking at him now, recalling what it used to be like between us, how I liked myself around him, how I felt good about the world and my place in it with him by my side, how I ached when he left for college, I remember what it feels like to truly love someone, for the right reasons, in the right way. Gabby taps my shoulder, bringing me back to reality. I turn to look at her. She is trying to tell me something. I can't hear her.
"Some air!"
she yells, pointing to the patio. She waves herself off like a fan. I laugh and follow her out. The moment we step outside, it's an entirely different world. The air has cooled, and the music is muted, contained by the building.
"How are you feeling?"
Gabby asks me.
"Me?"
I say.
"Fine. Why?"
"No reason,"
she says. "So, Mark doesn't dance, huh?" I ask, changing the subject.
"You love dancing. He doesn't take you dancing?"
She shakes her head, scrunching her eyebrows.
"Definitely not. He's not that kind of guy. It's fine. I mean, nobody's perfect but you and me,"
she jokes. The door opens, and Ethan walks through.
"What are you guys talking about out here?"
he asks. "Mark doesn't like dancing," I tell him.
"I'm actually going to see if I can get him to cut a rug once and for all," Gabby says.
She smiles at me as she leaves. It's just Ethan and me alone out here now.
"You look a little bit cold,"
he says as he sits down on the empty bench.
"I'd offer you my shirt, but I'm not wearing anything underneath."
"Might break the dress code," I say. I thought since I'm in L.A., I should wear a tank top, but...
"But it's February,"
he says,
"and this is Los Angeles, not the equator."
It's crazy how new this city feels to me, even though I lived here for so long, I tell him as I sit down next to him.
"Yeah, but you were 18 when you left. You're almost 30 now."
I prefer the term 29, I say. He laughs.
It's nice to have you back, he says. We haven't lived in the same city for, I guess, almost 13 years.
Wow, I say. Now I feel even older than when you called me almost 30. He laughs again.
How are you?
He asks me.
Are you well? Are you good?
I'm okay, I say. I have some things to work out.
You want to talk about them?
Maybe, I say, smiling. At some point? He nods.
I'd love to listen. At some point.
What's going on with you and Catherine over there? I ask. My voice is breezy. I'm trying to sound as if this is casual, and I'm pulling it off. Ethan shakes his head.
No, no, he says. Nothing. She just started talking to me, and I was happy to entertain her.
He smiles at me.
She's not who I came to see.
We look at each other, neither one of us breaking the gaze. His eyes are on me, focused on my eyes, as if I am the only other person in the world. And I wonder if he looks at every woman that way. And then he leans over and kisses me on the cheek. The way it feels, his lips on my skin, makes me realize I have spent years looking for that feeling and never finding it. I have settled for casual flings, half-hearted love affairs, and a married man, searching for that moment when your heart jumps in your chest. And I wonder if I should really kiss him, if I should turn my head ever so slightly and put my lips on his. Gabby and Mark come through the door. Hey, Gabby says before staring at us. Oh, sorry. No, I say. Hey. Ethan laughs.
You're Mark, right?
He says, getting up and shaking his hand.
Ethan, we didn't formally meet earlier. Yeah. Hey, nice to meet you.
Sorry, Gabby says. We have to head out.
I just found out I have an early morning thing,
Mark says. On a Sunday? I ask him.
Yeah, it's this thing at work I have to do.
I look at my watch. It's after midnight. Oh, okay, I say as I start to rise.
Actually, I could take you home,
Ethan says.
Back to Gabby's place later. If you want to stay for a while. Whatever you want.
I catch a coy smile come across Gabby's face for a split second. I laugh to myself. It's so obvious, isn't it? By coming back to L.A., I'm not just trying to build a better life with the support of my best friend. I've also reopened the question of whether Ethan and I have unfinished business between us. We've spent years apart. We've gone on to live two very different lives. And we're right back here, flirting off to the side at the party while everyone else is dancing. Will we or won't we? And, if I let him take me home, will it mean more to me than it means to him? I look at Ethan, and then I look at Gabby. Life is long and full of an infinite number of decisions. I have to think that the small ones don't matter, that I'll end up where I need to end up no matter what I do. My fate will find me. So I decide to... So I decide to go home with Gabby. I don't want to rush into anything. I turn and give Ethan a goodbye hug. I can hear through the door that the DJ just started playing Madonna's Express Yourself, and for a moment, I sort of regret my decision. I love this song. Sarah and I used to sing it in the car together all the time. My mom never let us sing the part about satin sheets, but we just loved the song. We'd listen to it over and over. I consider taking my goodbye back, as if the universe is telling me to stay and dance, but I don't. I should go home, I say to Ethan. It's late, and I want to get on West Coast time, you know?
I totally understand,
he says.
I had a great time tonight.
Me too. I'll call you? Ethan nods as he moves to give Gabby a hug goodbye. He shakes Mark's hand. He turns to me and whispers into my ear,
You're sure I can't convince you to stay out?
I shake my head and smile at him. Sorry, I say. He smiles and sighs ever so subtly, with a look that says he's accepted defeat. We walk back into the bar and say goodbye to everyone, Erica, Caitlin, Bryn, Catherine, and the rest of the people I've met tonight.
I thought for sure you were going home with Ethan, Gabby says as we are heading back to the car.
I shake my head at her. You think you know me so well. She gives me a doubting look. Okay, you know me perfectly, but I just feel like if things with Ethan and me are going to happen, they will happen on their own time, you know? No need to rush anything.
So you do want something to happen?
I don't know, I say. Maybe, eventually. It seems like I should be with an honest, stable, nice guy like him. He seems like a move in the right direction, men-wise. When we get to the car, Mark opens the doors for us and tells Gabby he's just going to take Wilshire Boulevard home.
That seems easiest, right? Less traffic?
Yeah, Gabby says, and then she turns around and asks me if I've ever heard of the Urban Light installation at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. No, I say. I don't think so.
I think you'll really like it, she says. They installed it a few years ago. We're going to end up driving by it, so I'll point it out. This is all part of my campaign to make you fall in love with L.A. again, by the way.
I'm excited to see it, I say.
People always say that Los Angeles has no culture, Gabby says. So, you know, I'm going to prove them wrong in the hopes that you'll stay.
You do remember that I lived here for almost 20 years, I tell her.
I meant to ask you.
She turns toward me as Mark looks ahead, driving.
How are your parents and Sarah?
Mom and Dad are good, I say. Sarah's at the London Ballet Company now and living with her boyfriend George. I haven't met him, but my parents like him, so that's good. My dad's doing well at work, so I think my mom is considering only working part-time. They don't send me money in any traditional sense, but for years they have given me such a large amount of money every Christmas that I almost feel like I'm getting a Christmas bonus. I don't know how much money my family actually has, but it certainly seems like a lot.
Your family doesn't come to the U.S. anymore?
Mark asks. No, I say. I always go over to see them.
Any excuse to go to London, right?
Mark says. Right, I say. Although that's not really true. They've never offered to come back to the U.S., and since they are the ones buying the ticket, I don't have a lot of say in the matter. I turn toward the car window and watch the streets go by. They are streets I didn't frequent as a teenager. We're in a part of town I don't know that well.
Did you have fun tonight? Gabby asks me.
Yeah, I did, I tell her, my gaze still on the sidewalks and storefronts we're passing. You have a lot of great friends out here, and it was awesome to see the girls from high school. Did Caitlin lose, like, 30 pounds?
Weight Watchers, I think, Gabby says. She's doing really well. As she was doing well before, though, too. Women don't need to be thin to be valuable.
I can see Mark smile into the rearview mirror, and I smile back at him. It is a small intimacy between us, our mutual eye-rolling at Gabby's political correctness. I start to laugh, but I hold it in. Gabby's not wrong. Women don't have to be thin to be valuable. Caitlin was the same person before she lost the weight as she is now. It's just funny that Gabby always feels the need to spell it out all the time. She can't take it for granted. Gabby's phone dings, and she picks it up. I watch as she reads the text message and immediately hides her phone. She's terrible at keeping things from me. What is it? I ask.
What is what?
On your phone.
Nothing.
Gabby, come on, I say.
It's not important. It means nothing.
Hand it over. She reluctantly puts the phone in my hand. It's a text message from Catherine. Going home with Ethan. Is this a terrible idea? My heart sinks in my chest. I look away and hand the phone back to Gabby without a word. She turns back to look at me.
Hey,
she says softly. I'm not upset, I say back, but my voice is thin and high-pitched. Upset is exactly how I sound.
Come on,
she says. I laugh.
It's fine. He can do what he wants.
I'm glad I didn't stay out late with him, looking to see if there was something between us. I specifically did not stay out with him tonight because I didn't want it to be a one-night thing, if it was anything. So there you go. Spares me the embarrassment. Gabby frowns at me. I laugh defensively, as if the harder I laugh, the harder I can push her pity off me and out the window. He's a great guy. I'm not saying he's not, but, you know, if that's how it's going to be with him, I don't need that. I look out the window again, and then immediately back at Gabby. I like Catherine, actually, I say. She seems great.
If I may, Mark interjects. I don't know much about the history between the two of you, but just because he's sleeping with someone else doesn't necessarily mean...
I know, I say, but still, it makes it clear to me that he and I are best left in the past. I mean, we dated forever ago. It's fine.
Do you want to change the subject?
Gabby asks me. Yes, I say. Please.
Well, should we go to breakfast tomorrow while Mark goes into work?
Yeah, I say, turning away from her and looking out the window. Let's talk about food.
Where should I take her?
Gabby asks Mark, and the two of them start rattling off names of restaurants I've never heard of. Mark asks me if I like sweet or savory breakfasts. You mean, do I like pancakes or eggs?
Yeah,
he says.
She likes cinnamon rolls,
Gabby answers at the exact same time I say, I like places with cinnamon rolls. When I was a kid, my dad used to take me to this donut shop called Primo's Donuts. They had big, warm cinnamon rolls. We'd go get one every Sunday morning. As I got older, we got busier. Eventually, a lot of my parents' time was spent shuttling Sarah to and from various rehearsals and recitals, so it became harder to find time to go. But when we did, I always ordered a cinnamon roll. I just love them so much. When I moved in with Gabby's family, Tina used to buy the cans of raw cinnamon rolls and bake them for me on the weekends. The bottoms were always burned, and she had a light hand with the prepackaged icing, but I didn't care. Even a bad cinnamon roll is still a good cinnamon roll. With a lot of icing, I tell Mark. I don't care if it's a day's worth of calories. Gabby, if you're up for it, I can try to find Primo's, and we can go there tomorrow.
Done, she says. Okay, we're almost at the museum. Up on the right here. You can sort of see the lights now, just right there.
I look forward, past her head, and I think I see what she's talking about. We breeze through the green light, hitting a red in front of LACMA, and now I see it perfectly. Streetlight after streetlight, rows of them, tightly lined up and lit. These are not the streetlights that you see today, the kind that shoot toward the sky and then curve over above the street. These are vintage. They look as if Gene Kelly might have swung on them while singing in the rain. I look at the installation, staring with purpose out the window. I suppose there is something very simple and beautiful about it. City lights against a backdrop of a pitch-black night does have a sense of magic to it. And maybe there's a metaphor here, something about brightness in the middle of... Oh, hell, I'm lying. The truth is, I don't get it.
Actually, Gabby says, why don't we get out? Is that cool, Mark? Can we park and take a quick picture by the lights? Hannah's first real night back in L.A.?
Mark nods, and when the light turns green, he pulls up to the curb. We get out of the car and head to the center of the lights. We take turns taking pictures of each other, round-robin style. Gabby and I stand between two rows of lights, and Mark takes pictures of us with our arms around each other. We wear oversized grins. We kiss each other on the cheek. We stand on either side of a lamppost and mug for the camera. And then I offer to take a picture of Mark and Gabby together. I switch places with Mark, getting out my own phone to take the photo. Gabby and Mark tuck themselves together, holding each other tight, posing underneath the lamps. I back up just a little, trying to frame the picture as I want. Hold on, I say. I want to get all of it. I can't get far enough away from them to get the top of the lights in the shot, so I walk to the edge of the sidewalk. It's still not far enough away, so I push the walk button and wait for a signal so I can stand on the street. Just one sec, I call out to them.
This better be good,
Gabby yells. The light turns red. The orange hand changes to a white-lit pedestrian, and I step down into the crosswalk. I turn around.